we don't go and write this story and tell other teams we're going to do this and really like imprint our narrative on this race, they're going to write the story. That literal conversation happened where we're in these meetings and people are saying, no, we can't do that. It's not the nature of our sport. And what I'm saying, it doesn't matter. We just need the other teams to think we're doing it. It doesn't matter even if we do it. We just need them to be talking about us. We need them to be at training, visualizing how they're going to deal with the fact that we're going to unleash Colin on them. And it doesn't matter if he does or doesn't. We just need them to be thinking about that so that they are letting us write the story, not them taking the pen.
That's four-time Olympian and gold medalist Simon Whitfield. And this is Difference Makers, a Christina Walker podcast. Welcome back or welcome to Difference Makers. I'm your host, Christina Walker, an athlete on the pursuit of discovering the amazing insights that my guests have to share. This week's guest is a special one, Simon Whitfield. Simon shares his beautiful story, as he says it, the poetry of sport. He discusses his successes as well as the races that may not have gone as he had hoped. His insights, wisdom, and absolute honesty is beyond refreshing, and I hope you all enjoy this as much as I did. Once again, this podcast is sponsored by Marathon Surfaces, suppliers of rubberized surfacing for running tracks, sport venues, walking paths, and safety surfacing for playgrounds. Now, without further ado, please welcome the one and only Simon Whitfield. Well, first, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me. I kind of wanted to start back at where you're from, Kingston. How long were you living in Kingston?
I was born in 1975 and I left when I was 16 years old. So I moved from Kingston to Australia and was in Australia for a few years and then have been in here in Victoria ever since. So it's been a long time since I've been back in K-Town. It's a great town to be from though.
Yeah. And did you start doing triathlons back in Kingston?
I did. I did the Charlotte Lake Triathlon, just north of Kingston. It was a pretty, it was utopic. You know, where I grew up was just lakes, abundance of lakes and outdoor activity enthusiasts. And it was a great place to get into the sport.
Yeah. So how did you get into it?
Just a bet with a friend's family. The Hollywood family organized the Charlotte Lake race. We would go there to a cabin in the summer. They organized the race. It just seemed like a natural thing for us to do. And the rest is history, so they say. It's a nice way to get into it. You know, it was really, maybe it's an overused term, but it was kind of organic. Just, it wasn't this thing that I'd seen and aspired to do. It was this thing that just kind of was happening around us and we just participated in. And then I fell in love with this sport, this outdoor activity.
Yeah. So did you find like the first time you competed in it that you felt like you loved it, or did it slowly grow over time?
I just liked competing and being outside. It had all the elements, I guess, that I really, that I was drawn to. Outdoor activity, a bit of adventure. It was competitive, but it was also, it had this real festival atmosphere that triathlon's done a very good job of fostering. It's, we were there for this race, but it was also like the pavilion had a whole like food fair and music. And it was the before and after was as big a part of it as the actual event.
Nice. Yeah. And have you done the K-Town Tri? I did that, the Kingston Triathlon, when I was 16.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was predominantly a runner up until university. And so I showed up with my dad's old triathlon bike. He used to do some triathlons, but he did one Ironman. And so yeah. I showed up with his bike and I remember the inspector being like, well, you definitely have the slowest bike on the course today. but did you do that? Did you do that triathlon ever?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up watching it and it ran virtually by my house along the there. And the old fort and like the coming into the marina and the city hall right there. It's a spectacular venue. And that's cool to think you've done that too. That's a fun, that's a great event. It's a classic, the K-Town Tri.
Yeah, it is. So then you said that you moved to Australia. How long were you there for?
2 years of high school, 3 years just living and becoming a professional athlete, and then moved to Victoria in 1997 and set up the National Training Center here with Paul Regensburg, Lance Watson, Barry Shepley, and the whole court of people. And loved Victoria. I grew up right on the lake, but I think there's my Aussie dad, you know, mm-hmm. grew up by the ocean. And I think that there's just something to be said for, it turns out salt water is good for you.
Yeah. Nice. And then was it in Victoria that you decided that you wanted to kind of go full into triathlons? Cause that's what, only 3 years before the Olympics?
Yeah, no, I was pretty full on from age of probably 15. I think I did my first race when I was 11, and then still played hockey and soccer and all these other sports. I think actually really helped me with the being, you know, it was like fine tune my athleticism and also my just tactical awareness and kind of how to play the game, not just compete at it. And then when I moved to Australia in 92, I went there under the suspicion that I was going to go there for school, but really in my mind it was to go learn from the best, because by then I had fully engaged that Olympic bug. I saw Dave Steen win a bronze medal at the 1988 Olympics in the decathlon. I had one of those chance meetings that's just, you know, you're a wide-eyed kid, and I'm at an all-comers track meet in Ottawa, the Ottawa Lions track meets there, and I'm on the far side of the track, and there's like the pole vault pit, and I'm just goofing around over there by myself. And this guy comes over and asks me to just help him set it up. Then it turns out to be Dave Steen, and he signs signs the back of my race bib. And for years and years, I think I even brought that race bib to Australia with me for the Olympics. Cause he just, you know, there's just something about those moments that you latch onto as a kid, but hopefully still as an adult, you let those little moments that feel like serendipitous that you had, you know, that sets you on a certain path. And I'd watched him compete with Daley Thompson and back in, you know, watching the Olympics, and then it was kind of just rolled from there. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I've definitely had some of those moments in my childhood as well, where it's like very monumental, and it's not until you're actually in your sport, or maybe for yourself after, that you can then reflect, oh, that actually might've meant a lot to me. And I find those moments really interesting and kind of sources of inspiration throughout your career. So then when you were in Victoria, how many people actually go to the Olympics for Canada for triathlon at a time?
In 2000, I was the only male to make the team, and then three women made the team: Sharon Donnelly, Isabel Turcotte-Baird, and Karen Montgomery.
Okay, and what were the qualifiers for that?
I think it's so long ago now. I went to Rio in the early 2000, I want to say in April. And I came second at a World Cup, and it was a big breakthrough for me. I'd had a couple other, you know, minor breakthroughs, but to come second at a World Cup to the world champion really just, it qualified me for the Olympics, but also just sparked in me this like, whoa, wait a minute. Like I ran with him, and I think he only beat me because I made a mistake. And so it just was that next little piece in the puzzle of going from like the audacious goal to the like, oh, maybe this isn't so audacious. I think I qualified in April, had that nice long build up to it, whereas a lot of the Australians and other big nations were really qualifying, like still qualifying, still getting their points together. I'd been seventh at the World Championships, maybe seventh or ninth in Montreal the year before. So I was gaining momentum, and then I secured a spot on the team, and then Triathlon Canada did a great job of supporting our Olympic campaign in this really simple, beautiful way. You know, it wasn't so complicated and layered as it got to be afterwards. And there's something to be said for that.
It is probably because the first time, that was the first Olympics for the triathlon, right?
Yeah, it was. It was first Olympics, and our funding, I think I got $2,000 in funding that year. But we had a lot of like really just key people in key places that just did it for their own reasons, you know, but they were like experts in their field, and they were super passionate, and they were naive enough to believe also. So we'd see these other teams that had a lot of money and a lot of prestige or whatever you want to call it. And we kind of just rolled along. Like, we were just like, yeah, cool. Like, I don't know, this is our little school bus, you know, and you've got your big coach trailer or whatever it is, but we're good with it. And it wasn't that way after that. A ton of funding came in, and with it, all of the like complications of that came with it. And I think a lot of us that were involved in 2000 had a bit of that, like, we couldn't articulate, but we could sense that we'd lost something, the simplicity, and the politics wasn't really there yet. And the like squabbling over funding and qualification criteria, mumbo jumbo, just, it wasn't there, you know? And so it was beautiful and simple. And my coach Lance Watson just did a phenomenal job of prepping this young guy who was a dish, you know, crazy enough to think that he could compete at that level. And he fostered that and really just gave me the beliefs and the tools and then the actual training program to execute. It was really special. And I didn't have any kind of experience like that after that. It was always way more complicated.
Yeah. I'm very fascinated by funding and sport, because for someone like myself, I've never been driven. I mean, I'm in rowing, so we don't really get that much money anyways, like personally, you know? So did you ever find throughout your career that as the funding increased, then you weren't as focused, or maybe it turned to more extrinsic motivators rather than like you kind of have to be so focused on yourself before, because there is really no other intrinsic motivation for you to train forward when you're going in 2000, right? Like, what, you're making $2,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of not even like, you don't really care. You're like, you're clearly there for yourself. Did you ever feel like throughout your career, then you were doing it for money or any sort of other, like, I feel like it's hard to kind of push those other things aside and remember why you're there every day.
Oh, absolutely. You take me back to being on the far side of Elk Lake. And let's say in 1999 or early 2000, I'm there, the rowers are there. And I feel like I'm truly just love the mastery of sport. Like, I just love putting a brick on the wall and then doing it and then just putting the next brick. And training is the only priority. And then going a year later, and that same spot, the rowers still just going backwards and doing their thing. And for what you just said, there's not a lot of extra funding. There's not a lot of sponsorship. But now a year later, I'm like, I got to get back because I got a sponsorship thingamabobber to get to. And and then it just snowballs from there all the way to like, you know, maybe you know that that pair of shoes is better than that other pair of shoes, but you're endorsing this pair of shoes, so you can't run in those other pair of shoes. So it might come all the way down to something as granular as that. But also in the big picture, you're just distracted. So that same run that the rower goes by and it's just so purely immersed in the like the just joy of mastery, I'm on the other side. I'm now on that trail running along thinking about like how much hay I can make.
Yeah. And did you find that you were able to be aware while you were in that process of doing that, or wasn't it not until afterwards?
No, I wasn't aware at all. I mean, that's, it's not better or worse. It's just different. That's like my anchor tenant. That's my, like, I always kind of come back to that now. So even on reflecting on it, it just is what it is. But if I could like whisper in the ear of my 24-year-old self, I would, you know, I wouldn't trade mastery for hay. There's a really sad moment that happened in there. Like, I got on a plane coming back from Australia and all of a sudden, you know, it was like, I'm meeting Wayne Gretzky. I'm meeting Jean Chrétien. I'm like, this ticket, it was just like this door opened and I passed through it. And then all my friends and my training partners and my life like went that other way. And I didn't really see at the time. It was, you can't see the forest for the trees at the time. You're enamored with your own story, and you've got this golden ticket, you know, that I can't, like, until you have it, you just don't really understand what it's like to have it, you know? And it's so intoxicating. And yet, as with anything, there's just this trade-off to make. And it's, like I said, it's not better or worse. It's just different. But in terms of performance, the difference piece is that you sacrifice performance for it. It doesn't seem like at that time you're like, oh man, I can buy an altitude tent. I don't even need to buy an altitude. I just need to pick up the phone and the person will send me one.
Right.
And this and that and that, and the carpet's rolled out for you all the time. And then you can't even see what, you're not trying to convert people to yes people, but everybody's kind of, you're in this funny relationship where people are almost afraid of saying no to you, even though you're just dying for someone to help constrain you. But nobody's communicating with you on that level anymore. They're just kind of going like, oh, well, here you go to the front of the line. And then they're rolling their eyes. And you might even be going like, I didn't even want that.
And it was because of that result.
Sure. Yeah. Because that's how we work, you know, and it just is what it is. I don't know. I mean, it's just, and then in that case, I think triathlon was in a bit of a, it's not unique. It's just we didn't have the mentors to lead us through, oh, we've had this happen before, where a federation went from minus funding to what do you need? You know, like literally here's blank check. What do you need? And we didn't have, and there was nobody to sit down and be like, hey, here are some of the pitfalls that are coming up. And whether or not I would have listened, who knows? Mm-hmm. But I didn't even have the person that could have stopped and gone and say, pulled aside and said, hey, just, you know, try this, try that.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that you had a different mindset then after 2000 compared to going into 2000?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, just the nature of competition and posturing, the like reaction to me winning within my own peers, in a lot of cases was one shot wonder, you know, or like, it felt like that to me, whether it was true or not, who knows. But to me, it was like, oh, I got to prove I'm not just a one shot wonder. And I, like, there was a really dramatic switch as far as I remember or perceive. There was a switch from like the wide eyed kid who just loved the competing and, you know, just racing and this is so fun, to like super serious and like, this isn't funny anymore. This is like, let's get this effing job done. And that mentality shift just didn't suit me. You know, it was like everybody wanted something. And so every relationship becomes a transaction. And then you can't see everything, just becomes outcome orientated. Right. Every little decision is an outcome orientated. There's no joy in the process. The process is driving you crazy, actually. That's what I tell myself.
Yeah. And so that was kind of after 2000 going into 2004. And then, I mean, maybe you can talk about first your race in 2000, and then as well as maybe your race in 2004 and how those kind of differentiated between each other.
Yeah. I mean, I've ended up telling the story many times, so it's shifted over time, but, the encapsulating story or the quintessential, like the essence of it is the strolling down to the start line in Sydney and joking about there might be sharks in the water, to 4 years later, someone joking with me about the same kind of thing and not thinking it's funny. Mm. You know, like that's the difference right there. I was just a wide eyed kid walking down the start line thinking this was just fantastical. Like I just was like, this is amazing. I went to school here. My boarding school mates are right over there. My dad's an Aussie. My grandmother's on the other side of the Harbor Bridge. She's 97. Da 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 da. Fairy tale, fudge. And then 4 years later, just been like, I want to get out of here. I don't even want to be here. I'm totally done with this whole thing. There's so much pressure. Nobody's getting along anymore. Everybody's mad at everybody. Everybody wants their piece. You know, everybody wants a piece of me. I want a piece of everything. this isn't fun anymore. And then this like shift to like some kind of neutrality in Beijing where I can just perform, just kind of like a, my dad said, just stop, don't get caught in the fog, you know?
Yeah.
It was like a powerful little piece that he gave me. Then I kind of temporarily distilled it all. And then a totally different experience in London, like a totally just one bison too many. One just had to go. It's that nature of competition and all that thing is like, well, if some is good, more is better, right? So let's just keep going.
So what propels you, if you, it sounds like you didn't have the greatest of time in 2004, what propelled you to then go forward into 2008?
Necessity, I guess, maybe a bit. It's what I was good at. Still the fundamental things at the end of the day were the same, as I just loved competing. And I really did understand early on, you know, again, you have these little moments in your life that really help like set a path. And I, so I had an uncle who had multiple sclerosis and had all this joy and like humor and artistic ability. And yet he was like, he was confined to a hotel, a hospital bed. And he just would never let me forget in a really nice way, but like what a privilege and a like opportunity I had to express my gifts, you know, cause he's like lying there. He's like, don't you dare not like, you get to run around. He painted with a mouth brush. And so he just in a really subtle, lovely way, kind of kept nudging to say like, don't you dare not go express your physicality. Cause that's your gift.
Yeah, and take it for granted.
Yeah. So I think I like was able to just, when all of it stripped away, I just kept staying at it because of that piece. And it's what I love to do and et cetera, et cetera. But it was different. It changed. You know, there was certainly like a, and it's not a complaint, it just is what it is. But there was a sense of, they just lost a bit of the joy in it. You know, it was right. A bit much more of a job. Mm-hmm. And so be it. I mean, whatever. That's the journey.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it's really difficult, especially as someone like yourself, where you come out of such a huge win, where it's like the first, it's not only just the first time that somebody has won gold in triathlon at the Olympics, but it's also for Canada. And then having to deal at the age of 25. So then having to deal with all those pressures and probably at the time it's, you feel like you're on cloud nine, but then something might not feel right. So I think it's a very difficult path to then be able to have that awareness to shift back to, okay, is this what I love to do? This is a gift, reminding yourself that like those daily gratitudes are so important. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about your race, both in 2000 and 2008, your final kick. Have you ever been known for having such a sprint?
I think that was always known for.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing that it was the one card I had, you know, I swam fairly well. I wasn't a front pack swimmer, but I always managed to get myself in the right spot. And the same with riding. I rode, maybe I was underrated riding, you know, I was flew under the radar a little bit. And then running, I could run to a certain level, but I needed races to unfold a certain way. And in fact, when the sport changed after 2008 and this Alistair Brownlee, who went on to win the next two Olympics, he just ran straight from the front, never slowed down. My card was gone. I couldn't keep up with long enough to sprint with them.
Right.
But with the whole premise that if I could, I would, I was like, oh man, that's the one card I got. Like, mm-hmm. I ran. And I think it came from that. When he was young, he was just swimming, biking and running. I was playing soccer, badminton, you know, hockey. So I had that explosiveness, that athleticism that just, I don't know.
What do you think about in your final, like, I just watched your two races most recently again. And I mean, I personally think when I go into a sprint, it's so much more than just that physicality of it. I take in more emotion and I think about like other people's energy coming in. Like it's a more spiritual thing for me. And I wondered if what's going on in your head when you're going through that, like that last minute or something where I really do think that that is like mental toughness, or somebody could be a faster sprinter than you, but if you have the heart, then I think that you would beat them. But that's a personal view. I don't know what you think.
I explain it to myself now as that flow state being that absence of your, like your prefrontal cortex just shutting down. So it sounds so, I hate the fact that to me it's so bland now, you know, like that's the scientific, like your frontal cortex turns off. You no longer discussing things with yourself and you're just in that intuit state and you just complete whatever percentage of training you've done. You know, you like put all your cards on the table. If you prepare plus one over the person you're beside, then you get it or you don't.
Yeah.
And at some point, and to me, it's like you're just able to maintain propriety of your breath for one more breath than your competitor. And in terms of staying there, you're right. It's like all of those emotions and all that internal narrative come in. And are you able to just stay in that spot where you see it pass instead of ever engaging in it? Because the moment you engage in it, it's over. You know, right. That's second place, because second place just lost propriety of their breath. They hitched just one second before the other person did, and it's over.
Did you find that in 2008?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Like turned a corner and there's a distinct moment that only I'm privy to where I'm sprinting and then I realize, oh my God, I this is too far out. Mm. And then, right. And then I go and then Jan Frodeno goes over the top because he just didn't, you know, yes. He pained his breath, his pacing, his whatever. We explain it all these different ways, but at the end of the day, it's like his internal conversation just stayed quiet for one more frame than mine did. I sprinted, realized I'd gone too early, had the conversation in my head, like, oops, that's too early. And then it's instantly over. And preparation, every bit of preparation you do leads you like to whether or not you pass that test or you don't. Do you pass that test last, I guess, you know?
And how would you prepare for that in training?
I mean, I think it's like, it all comes down to, it's that N plus one. Like, do you think about it more than your competitors? Right. And when I think about it, I don't mean just lying there thinking about it, although I also mean that. But I mean, like, you put yourself in a place in training more times where you just, in your mind's eye, you can clearly see the finish line, all the way to the finish line without losing propriety of breath. And can you just stack those, like I referenced before, can you just put those little blocks on top of each other so that when you come to the start line, there's this unseen moment where everybody goes like, shh, and then someone goes like, uh-oh, like, you know, Johnny's got more blocks and that's it. And then the race transpires. And I don't know. I mean, Paula Finley, this incredible Canadian athlete who just won the in triathlon, the biggest race of 20, the only big race of 2020, but the pro challenge. I think in that race, she just thought about it one more time. And also everybody else thought about her and one more time than anybody else, you know, like it was like that too, those combining things. And so all of that physical preparation was actually about being physically prepared, yada, 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 but also scripting that so that it unfolded how she wanted it to, not how someone else wanted it to.
Right.
That I've used this example before, but like it'd be like the difference between the fiction writer and the Netflix watcher. You know, the fiction writer wrote the story, the Netflix watcher needed to see it cast by somebody else. That's second place to me. First place, like, wrote the story, second place watched it happen.
Mm. No, that's beautifully said. I think that's so true. And I wonder if that's a commonality across sports, in all sports, or in sports where it's more individualized. And it's actually interesting because as many people may think of triathlon as being a very individualistic sport, before this, I watched an interview of one of your teammates, Colin Jenkins, and he talked about, I thought this was so amazing, of saying like his job for, it was 2008, right? Yeah. For his job in 2008 was to help to bring you up in the cycling portion of the triathlon. And he had no regard for himself or that he was feeling, oh, I wanted to see how well I could do. It was like, this is a team sport, and he was treating it like a team. And I think even in those individualistic sports, the more that you think of the bigger picture of who you're impacting, or rather than just someone, more of thinking like, I'm competing for Canada, it's Canada that's going forward, not myself, you know, Christina Walker, or Simon Whitfield, I think people have more success. What's your thoughts on that?
First of all, I think I would assume it transpires across all things. So whether you're a musician or an artist or a scientist, is like, it actually, it's not an individual or a team thing. It's simply a function of like, how preoccupied and consumed are you, you know, are you just totally and utterly wholeheartedly engrossed in this thing? And then are you able to just apply? And then Colin's such a great example, because it's funny, because at the end of the day, I realized years later, like, it still was an individual sport. We kind of pretended it was like a team sport, but really we were just trying to control the narrative. You know, that was just the story. The conversations that preluded that like was about that, like, hey, if we don't go and write this story and tell other teams we're going to do this and really like imprint our narrative on this race, they're going to write the story. That literal conversation happened where we're in these meetings and people are saying, no, we can't do that. It's not the nature of our sport. And what I'm saying, it doesn't matter. We just need the other teams to think we're doing it. It doesn't matter even if we do it. We just need them to be talking about us. We need them to be at training, visualizing how they're going to deal with the fact that we're going to unleash Colin on them. And it doesn't matter if he does or doesn't. We just need them to be thinking about that so that they are letting us write the story, not them taking the pen. And that's what I wanted. That's what we were trying to create. That's what I wanted. I wanted Bevan Doherty and Jan Frodeno and the British and Javier Gomez to be gone thinking about like, oh man, I don't know what to do. Like, they're going to have this teammate and they're going to da 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 da. And sure enough, the race unfolded like that. We deployed Colin. We didn't even have to deploy him very much. We didn't really actually need to use him that much. We just needed other teams to think we were, and to be watching us and to letting the race us write the script. So in a sense, I felt like right to the final bit, like, we had the pen. We were writing how this was going to unfold. We were kind of dictating to other teams. And just, you know, at the end of the day, Jan was able to grab the pen and be like, and that happened. And that's the poetry of sport. But I think that transpires across all things. It's not manifestation. It's just like, that has a whole other connotation to it. This is, to me, is like, you can't choose the direction you're going, but you can choose the direction which you're going to err. You know, so we were just like, well, let's just err in this direction and let's see how it unfolds. And it unfolded as it did.
Do you believe in manifestation?
No, I don't. I think that got me to sit down by the campfire and you got really into it, I would say that I believe in the realm of infinite possibility, that all things are happening at the same time, and that every iteration of anything you can think of is all happening at the same time. Not to get too esoteric, but that's the only thing that makes sense to me, that I can like, the thing I cling to is like, it's not my quote, but there is no clarity. There's only the will to endure and the faith to live on. Like, when I read that, it's a Ken Liu quote. It's the first line of The Paper Menagerie, my favorite book. And I read that and I was just like, oh my goodness, that's so true. Like, there is no clarity. You don't get to ever get it confirmed. So whether you're religious, you have faith, if you believe in manifestation or not, you don't get a clarity statement. And I'm okay with that. This is contentment. And then from there, I just explain things to myself in that manner, that all things that could have happened are happening. And the version I'm playing out is, if I do have any agency over it, I'm just kind of nudging it in the one direction that I think it might go. And, you know, if I, as soon as I think I know what's going to happen, I'm guaranteed that's the one thing that's not going to happen.
Right.
Maybe I'm a degree, you know, what do they say? Like when you fire an arrow, you don't aim right at the target, you drift it in.
Mm-hmm.
That along that line, like I'm not aiming at the target. I'm just trying to drift it into that general vicinity and be content with the result.
Yeah. It seems like it's more about, rather than manifestation, it's like your version of the process and focusing on the process, which people could call manifestation. Like if you're so focused on doing something and being fully submerged in it, that could also be defined as being fully submerged in the process of that activity. Whereas maybe manifestation for you is just thinking that something's going to happen, even though you can't really control that narrative.
Right. And I don't think that. I don't think that
yeah. We are
a function of things we think about. We're some unknown combination of all those things. And if anyone knows the answer, that's great. You know, I'm happy for
it. No, that's awesome. And then for 2012, what unfolded there? I know that you had an accident.
I think I call it now the manufactured noble exit. I didn't know that at the time, you know, I wasn't like, that's what, there you go. That's another manifestation thing is like, we don't know what's really running in our subconscious the whole time. So I feel like upon reflection that I found something to grab onto because I no longer believed I could climb that mountain, you know? So I was like, I didn't maliciously think I'm going to manufacture this thing, but I there was an opportunity to like kind of distract from the fact that I just knew I was being asked to, I was being told maybe I can, you know, you can win, you can get medal, da, da, da. And I was like, no, I can't. These young kids are going to crush me. It'd be a great, amazing result. But the funding doesn't work like that, right? The funding is like going like, well, that's great. And you know, you may feel that way, but don't say that out loud because what we're paying you to win here. And so now I'm the flag bearer and all of the extra bits that come with it. And then, so then this thing happens with Paula and I feel like now I look back on it as like, I latched onto that because it was a chance to be like, well, if that thing just hadn't happened, then who knows how what I would have done, you know? So I like got myself immersed in a distraction because I couldn't really face the fact, I didn't want to face the cold hard reality that I was about to get like served in. So, you know, who knows? And the sad part of it was just, I didn't get to taste the cake we made, you know, like we did all that training. That's what John Brown, my coach, said. He's like, oh man, I just wanted to know how we did. Like the crash robbed us of knowing how we actually did. Did we bake a cake that collapsed at the end? Did we like, who knows? And so, mm-hmm. But if you ask me, I do think it was just that's something in human nature is to find a way to like that pressure mounts and mounts. And at some point the foundation cracks and then you, maybe it looks like the structure's still there, but actually underneath it, you're like, those bolts have all collapsed. I'm done. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what happened there. Like I just found a way to kind of exit stage left and latch onto something that was hard to argue with, right? It felt noble. I'm standing up for another athlete. Upon reflection, I should have just left that athlete to stand up for themselves. They didn't need me to carry their burden. That was theirs. Yeah. So I think I did it for my own. We all do things for our own reasons, and that was mine.
Mm-hmm. Was that your last race?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Wow. Came in with the boom and went out with a bust. I won a medal and I hit a speed bump and so be it, you know, I don't know. It's a poetry sport. I crossed the finish line in 2008 and I've told this story a million times, but I had that initial disappointment and then I walked 10 feet over. I'm still trying to catch my breath. My dad's like hanging over the grandstand and he's just like smiling ear to ear. And he's like, how was that? And I said, oh my God, I just about won again. Like, I can't believe it. And my dad said, oh, welcome to the poetry sport. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And he's, the 8 years ago, you beat a German who inspired another German who got you back. And I never struggled with it. Like I just, it was my, he was right. It's the poetry sport. And so I've struggled with different aspects of 2012, but the actual like result, I don't know. So be it, whatever. It mm-hmm. is what it is. I did it. At the end of the day, I still did it because I loved it. And I felt really privileged to be able to do it.
Did you ever have a race where you felt like it was fully encompassing of your training? And maybe this is 2000 for you because you got a gold medal, so obviously you're on top. But was there a race where the result didn't show all your preparation and the race itself?
Yeah, it's 2000, definitely. That was just that. And that was hard because I remember I went to the Spanish, I think Spain played the U.S. in the gold medal basketball game, and I went. And when they won, I still got goosebumps. And when the U.S. won, but whatever, I still got goosebumps just watching that shot and the winning. And I was like, oh, thank goodness I still get that. Like, I had this real moment of like, have I just kind of hit peak performance at 24, and that's like everything else will always be secondary to this? And in a sense, yes. You know, I could never visualize it the way I could. In 2000, I felt like I was just watching. I was just reenacting a movie I'd already watched. I was like, oh, I've run through this so many times. I went to the Botanical Gardens as a 10-year-old in 1985. My parents took me there. I scratched my name in a tree, in a bamboo. I was 10 years old. Everything Australian was the best. And I passed the world champion like 10 feet from that tree.
Oh, wow.
You know, like there's so many little synchronicity moments that whether or not, whatever weight you want to put on that, it's just a lot of them. I went, when Juan Antonio Samaranch announces that Sydney's going to be the Olympic venue, I'm at the Opera House. I'm 500 feet from the Opera House at Circular Quay, and I walk to the Opera House and stand on the start line, and nobody else is there. And I'm like, I feel like I got the map first. Like I'm like, huh, there's no one else here. Like I felt like all those other people that thought they were going to be there were somewhere else visualizing it. I was standing like, I'm like, huh, like right about here, kind of. So all those things happened and came together, but then the rest of your career, like there's this like feeling like, uh-oh, like how do I recreate that? You know, how do I go find those 50 different, 100 different things that all culminated that one spot? So there was a little bit, my whole career, there's a little bit of sense of like, ugh, I don't know how to duplicate that.
Yeah.
That just is what it is. I don't, you know, that's, so be it again.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's what it was? It was like the next 12 years you were trying to replicate that or find that again, that sort of feeling that you had in 2000?
Yeah, in some sense, sure. Yeah, it's like you kind of like, I hate to make a, it's like you, the, yeah, I don't know. You just cannot, you can't recreate that, or you, even just the seed of thought that might be the case is kind of always existing. And then, so 8 years later, I visualized so much of that race, but I missed the last 100. Like I never actually I didn't realize how far it was from the roundabout to the finish line. So when I started sprinting, I turned the corner and started sprinting because I was like, oh, I'm going to end this right here. And then I was like, I looked up and I was like, oh my God, that's so far away.
Oh, wow.
So something like the one piece of distraction that I had just never let me finish watching the like preamble movie in my own head. I'd seen it all the way to like that roundabout, but every time I went to watch the last bit of the video in my head, you know, a sponsorship call came or someone knocked at the door or what have you, like some distraction managed to like penetrate that sacred like process of picturing in your mind's eye how this you want to see this unfold.
Yeah, I saw that in when I rewatched it, And I actually called my dad because I was like, I wanted to talk to him about it. I was like, it's so interesting because in 2000, when you went for your sprint, it was like, without a doubt, it was yours. You were like, no, this is mine. And even, what's his name? Who was came second in 2000?
Vukovic, yeah.
Vukovic, yeah. And he was like you in 2008, where he saw you go past and then he was like, well, and then just took second, was like, this is it. And yeah. It kind of resembled you in 2008. And I mean, I can't speak for you. This is just what I was kind of the way I was processing it, was that you were then in second, well, went for first, and then Jan passed you and you were like, well, this is what it is. Whereas in 2000, I don't know. It just felt like you were so in it the last, exactly how you explained in the last like 100 meters. It was like, there's no way anybody is catching me.
Yeah. That's that. I mean, that's it, isn't it? You just, yeah. That's the beauty of sport, I guess.
It really is.
You just never know that last. And that's played out over and over and over again. Whatever, it's a team sport or individual sport, it's like, you know, I love team sports. I have an envy for team sports because you have to take that like individual effort and then like mesh it with this collective conscious of like, hey, are we all on the same page here? Can we all believe in this? And so I think that's really neat. It's took me a long time. Now I play team sports. I play soccer partly because I love being on the bench. I love the preamble and the game before the game starts. And I don't speak team, you know, like I
right.
speak individual sport. And so I never spoke team properly. And so it's so humbling. To have to figure that piece out and to be on the same page as people, because our training was always a truce. An individual sports athlete's training partners, it's always, you're always just, you've come to a truce. You're not actually, you know, you can frame it any way you want, but an individual sport, you just come to truce with your teammates or your training partners. Whereas in a rowing eight, like it's not a truce. It's like a bond. It's a mm-hmm. true, like this thing only goes as quick as the fastest, the weakest link. Totally. And so it's a different experience to be those two things. And I really, they both have their strengths and weaknesses and their benefits, but that piece I have a little bit of envy for that, like, and a real appreciation of how difficult that must be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting with rowing. That's something that I've always been intrigued by, which is the ability to have your teammates as some of your biggest competitors in certain times of training, where like even right now for us, in the next 2 months, we're going into selection for the 8 and the 4, and you're competing against your teammates for those spots. And so they're your biggest competitors pretty much for life. Like, but then once that's settled, then, and you get the result back and you're hopefully in the boat, then you have to then be completely bonded with them and work as teammates, as like, we're going to do this together to then find another competitor to beat.
In the lead up, there's a truce, isn't there? Because there is a notion of like, hey, if we compete too much all the way through, we won't have anything left for the actual race.
Definitely. So
we've got to have a truce that when it says go easy, we go easy. And when it says go mostly hard, we go mostly hard, not all out. That's neat. I love that. That's the beauty of sport. Isn't there anything? I mean,
yeah, we actually, that's funny that you bring that up, because we had a discussion as a team last week, which was certain workouts. Like it was just kind of hysterical, because it was like, we had to talk about how we need to dial it back sometimes and not be so competitive, you know. And it's like, who has these conversations of like, we need to just work in a little bit less of a harder zone right now, because we're going to burn each other out and right. respect each other as teammates. Whereas like, not every day. And I mean, this, I could get some critique on this, because I think every rower is so different, but if you go in with that mentality of like, every day I need to destroy my competitor, I think you're right. Like, you then end up exhausting yourself before you're at the start line and you're in the position to be a competitor.
My favorite competitor ever was Hamish Carter. He's a New Zealander, because just as him as a person, you know, he was just such an exemplary person. But I trained with him a bit in 2005, and he just won the Olympics, and he was, you know, he's like this, just this legend of our sport. And yet he, when we went to the pool, he just did his own thing. He wasn't affected by the needing to win a workout. And you watched him swim and you'd be like, wait, I don't understand how that guy comes out of the water first all the time. How is that a thing? You just like, look at him. He's never at the front of these workouts. But then you realized after a while watching him, you're like, oh, but he's always just like, he's always doing what he needs to do. He was just such a disciplined individual, and he didn't let his ego get away from him. He just knew what he had on the schedule, and he did what it said on the schedule. And if you were trying to compete with him in that aspect, it's not like he got annoyed at you. He didn't care. He was just like, all right, like good job. And, you know, off he went and did his thing. And I really admired that in him. He didn't do this. Mm-hmm. He wasn't living and dying by everything. He was just like steady Eddie. He just did his thing and had a smile when he arrived and smiled when he left and got the work done. It was extraordinary.
I think you're absolutely right in the sense that I think that's like the suppression of, or the control of one's ego.
Right.
Which is not letting your surroundings take control of what you're going to do in that day or in that time.
The guy won the pro challenge on the weekend that Paula won. He kept saying after the race, oh, he's Gustav Eden from Norway. And he just kept saying, I was in control at that point. Oh, I felt like I had good control at that point. This other reference, the guy asked him another question. He said, oh yes, at that point, I also felt like I had good control. Mm-hmm. He was just like, all he did was just, while everybody else was going off the front and getting caught up in the other aspects of races, he just finally, he knew exactly what he had to do, and he just went about doing it. And then when the dust settled, this like one guy just came and emerged from the front of it and just ran right off the front. And Paula very much did the same thing. And it was just neat to see the way he said it. And talking about, I mean, again, creating mythology or like a myth around why that reason should be that he should win. The one piece in all of that that was, you know, he did it in this very institutional way. He just very clinical about it. But he wears this hat that he found on the side of the road in Japan that is from a Taiwanese temple, and he calls it his good luck hat. And he wore, so he's got all sponsored up, and yet he's got this kind of ridiculous hat on. And I just was like, oh man, he's even built into it this mythology, this like, I'm clinical and I'm 1%, you know, like there's a little bit of magic here. That little story, I think every competitor knows that about him now. When he's there, they're like, oh man, that's it. Gustav with his lucky hat. Like, how can I beat him? It's like, of course you do. Of course you're winning like that. That's the way that should be.
Yeah, it's probably so raw and authentic and just himself, you know? He's like, I don't care. This is me.
He's just great. He's so unassuming. He's super humble. Been making excuses. Spoke about his race really honestly and clinically with this little smirk. He's got that smirk, that the champion smirk, you know? I see that. Look at that. He's smirking. My lucky hat. And he's like,
yeah, that's awesome. The fact that you've been to 4 Olympics, obviously they're all different. Did you find that you had different distractions at each games? And can you pinpoint those distractions that actually affected you or made you succeed? Or how you were in the village prior to the games, like obviously in 2012, like what was that like to even be carrying the flag and having that sort of attention? Then, okay, now I actually need to go back in and be a competitor right now.
I think the trajectory or what have you is it was all to do with how much we spoke a little bit about this before, the ego piece. It's like how much I was consumed with my own story and how much I was stuck in my head around like the bigger meaning of this, the legacy aspect, the ego / fame aspect of it. I was in Vietnam last year, and I went and played soccer at this soccer club, and the skill level was as high as I'd ever been around. And yet the celebrations were nothing. Like, they would score the most incredible goals that if we scored at Bays here, we would just stop. Like, we would stop. Like, done here. Our work here is done. We would talk about it at the pub for hours later. We would dissect the score. We would literally write a report of the race or their game. There was something very Buddha about it. You know, like, the guy would score this flying kick cross to win the game and would just walk back to the middle and just start the next thing. I guess what I'm saying is that I was some version on that scale somewhere between hyper celebrating or hyper disappointed. And the better I did, the races that I truly performed in, I was more the guy who just scored the goal and walked back to center. And the races that I wasn't like that I didn't perform, I was the, like, over celebrate or, you know, or buried in the disappointment. It's all ego. And so This like training effect that we have and we do, and this like this discipline that you have to build the building blocks really is about just pushing all of those other things aside and just simply setting up an intuit state so that you can get to that event and you can just proceed to, you know, express the work you did and not get in the way. Mm-hmm. Like, think about it. Just, and the science is really clear on that. That's, as soon as you engage your prefrontal cortex in advanced thinking, the consequences of, you're now no longer engaged in the actual moment or the actual process of. And I've had that play out time and time again in soccer and in Masters over 35 on Vancouver Island, where the ball comes across and I either make first contact with it and hit it in the back of the net because I didn't think about it, I just did it. Or just before it gets to my foot, I think, oh man, this is going to be a great goal. And I miss the net. And right. So my four Olympics were all some sort of trajectory, some sort of expression of whether or not I was able to just be there and perform and express the training I had done, or if I got in my own way. Mm-hmm. And if I won a medal, I generally got out of my own way. And if I didn't, then I orchestrated that. I was the architect of my own demise.
I heard an interview of Sean White one time that he talked about how his headspace going into a run, and he was like, honestly, I try to kind of like dumb it down or put less emphasis on the performance and think of that at the end of the day, I get to go home and I see my family, and that's great. So I'm just going to hold on to that. Like, this is really cool what we get to do right now. Like, this is awesome. Like, kind of acknowledging it. But then putting past all that other attachment onto that success and realizing, wow, like, whether you're in a boat or on a bike or swimming, you're just fully so immersed in the process of it that you're enjoying every stroke or every stride, that you don't get succumb to your surroundings, and you can then perform at your highest level.
Absolutely. I love it. I mean, you're either present or you're not. That's mm-hmm. the thing I think about those races is I think I only remember them because I've been asked about them and I've made up a story that like fits, but I don't actually remember. I don't think you remember those actual races you did. You just recreate a synergy of it. Like, you just kind of go, yeah, I don't know, that this sounds about right. Because you're so immersed in it, your brain's not actually filing it away in memory. It's just going like, I don't have oxygen for memory. I just got to do this silly thing that this silly person needs me to do. You know, that's it. It's ridiculous. I love pathos. We were just talking about it on our bike ride today. Pathos to me is the benevolent heart in the ridiculous. And like, it's ridiculous. You just attached a bunch of seats to a boat and then you put a bunch of oars on it. And then you were like, let's just go like this.
And do that for years.
Yeah, absolutely. Just do that over and over again. And triathlon is exactly the same. Like, let's just be bad at all three things, but not quite as bad as other people. And you make up this sport. And that's soccer for me these days. And I got asked a little while ago why I love soccer so much. I was like, I don't know. I get there. They don't really care how I'm doing. Like, if I started saying like, oh, life is like this, they'd be like, hey, you know, kind of the deal here. Like, just go on the field and stop the little round thing from going in the square thing and then try and get the round thing and push it in the other square. I just love that. I just think it's so great because it's so stupidly simple. And that to me is pathos. It's like the benevolent heart and how ridiculous that really is. And I think I tell myself that that's just, if you kind of like look for pathos, not even look for it, you just welcome it or whatever it is, you just, then that is the best you can do. It's like, accept that we all struggle, that is not better or worse. It's just different. There is no clarity, and that there's, just tell yourself there's some benevolent heart in all the ridiculousness of this.
Mm-hmm. That's perfectly said. I think we'll end it there. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. The site is, it's a nice opportunity to go through things that I don't know, explain it to myself. So here I am. Definitely.
Well, you have a great story and I'm happy that I'm able to share it. That's episode 2 with Simon Whitfield. Now, if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it and give us a follow on Spotify. Thank you to my systems engineer, Cindy Payne, Claire Brion for background music, and a huge thank you to you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. Stay tuned for our next episode airing Monday, February 8th. I'll be interviewing a teammate of mine, Conlon McCabe, who shares his incredible insights on his journey as an athlete, as well as his road to Tokyo 2021. Enjoy the day. Go get after it. Thanks, everyone.